Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of August 12th, 2011. If this week's market madness has you feeling a little sick to your stomach, let's all settle down for a moment and, just like a doctor would, diagnose the problem.
It's a great contraction, and you can't just wish it away.
Drat! Then I guess we'll have to find the right medicine. Let's start by not freaking out.
We're trained to get away from things that are causing us pain. You know, if it weren't so, we would have been eaten by saber-tooths a long time ago.
But instead of running away, we told you to call in, and lots of you did. Whether you're looking to buy a home or change up your investments, our advice boiled down to this.
Stock market is a 13-year-old daughter of the world economy. It's the ultimate drama queen.
Too bad we can't just send her to her room. Just like your investments, we are here for the long haul on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Oh, Lordy, holy moly, here we go again.
Good evening. You might want to be strapped in and hang on tight.
The worst day on Wall Street in more than 2 years.
3 days in a row, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has moved
triple digits, down more than 500 points.
Markets saw a big leap yesterday.
Well, yesterday they were happy. Today they're unhappy. It's a bipolar market. It's manic depressive.
What the hell is going on?
Yes, what the hell is going on? I'll tell you what's going on. All those crazy traders did not listen to my friend and our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore on last week's show. You know, the one where we talked about the S&P downgrade and noted that this was not a time to panic. So let's try it again, shall we? Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Tess.
So it's been a whole week since the last time we talked to you. Anything happened?
Yeah, that is ancient history. Can you remember a week ago?
I know.
How innocent we all were then.
Seriously. But, you know, you and I talked about the fact that we didn't know what was going to come on Monday when the markets opened, that either investors were going to say, you know what, we knew a downgrade was coming, or things were going to fall apart. Well, they fell apart on Monday, and then things recovered on Tuesday. And then, I mean, from there on, it was just a crazy wild ride. Should we have expected that, do you think?
You know, I think reasonably, yes. Like, the markets are always a pretty good fireworks show, and this week they have been in rare form. They don't necessarily reflect what they should reflect, right? So the markets reflect what people who are buying and selling things think. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that that is what's going on in our economy, as you and I have talked about before.
Right. There's a real disconnect between Wall Street and the economy writ large.
Yes, exactly. Well, at least in terms of markets, because if you look at other markets, like the bond markets, they were just fine. They were supporting treasury bonds, and they still are.
Downgrade? What downgrade?
Exactly. Right? Mortgage rates are at almost record lows. You know, there are a lot of things that were just completely unaffected by this. But of course, we all look at a few indices and we think, oh my God, the world is ending. But it rarely is, which is why panicking never helps.
And, you know, Heidi, I heard this week that August is a particular time to not be paying attention to what's going on Wall Street because so many people are gone. Where does that factor in?
Yeah, that anyone with any good sense would be on the beach right now.
Right.
Obviously, ourselves excluded. But I think that there is something to that. When you don't have a lot of participation in the market, you can see things that aren't really there because it's fewer people influencing a lot more stocks, right? So it's the same way that if you go into a dinner party and it's like two or three people, one person can really dominate the room. But
right.
If it's a big dinner party, then there's more chances of, you know, different kinds of conversations going on and you get a better sense of what's going on in the world. And the markets are kind of like that.
Bigger dinner parties are always more fun.
Yes, and more delicious usually than
exactly.
Trading stocks.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so what we said on last week's show, and frankly the week before that and the week before that was don't freak out, folks. Is that still holding?
I would say yes. I mean, I would like somebody to write a long story about what has ever been accomplished by freaking out in any context. First of all, nothing is permanent. We know that. The whole economy is cyclical. We're in a cycle right now, one we'd like to be out of. But also, you know, stocks go up, stocks go down. The world changes. And so we have to have more of an idea of flexibility. Of course, that's really hard when you're looking at your portfolio and those numbers are ticking down.
Right.
But as long as you have followed good advice up until now and you feel like you're well prepared, then why change that? The world hasn't changed because of 1 or 2 days of trading.
So I guess, as I was saying earlier this week, if it bothers you, just don't open your statement, right?
I have to say this is a good argument for denial this week.
All right. Our New York Bureau Chief joining us once again. Thank you so much for coming in, Heidi.
Thank you, Tess.
And for more on dealing with fear in the markets, visit our Making Money blog at marketplace.org. Heidi mentioned that mortgage interest rates are touching all-time lows. It is a great time to be a borrower, provided you can pay it all back, of course. But woe is you if you are a saver. And this week, the Federal Reserve didn't do you any favors. The Fed's Open Market Committee came out and basically said that its benchmark interest rate is likely to stay low for a long time coming, meaning your savings accounts, your CDs, well, they are just hanging out, sipping lemonade on the veranda. Marketplace's David Gura has more.
If you listen to Marketplace this week, you've already met Jane Dougal. She's 65 and a librarian from Rhinebeck, New York.
At one point in my life, retirement had this lovely glow to it that it was you could sit on a beach and, you know, have a glass of wine and relax and your days would be long and leisurely. And now it's, I wonder if I can retire by the time I'm 70 or 75.
There are a lot of Americans like Jane who may have to delay retirement. And there are many more who are already retired and are being squeezed by the low interest rates we've experienced over the last 3 years. Justin Wolfers is an economist at the Wharton School. He says when interest rates go down, it's a double-edged sword.
Those of us who are borrowing, buying houses, or more importantly, firms that are making investments and opening new factories, this is good news for them.
That's why the Fed cut interest rates, to spur economic growth. But, Wolfers says, here's the other edge of the blade.
It definitely hurts those of us who are saving and trying to live off that income.
If your money's in something that traditionally has been safe, like a money market fund or a CD, your nest egg isn't going to grow very much. For retirees right now, interest rates don't keep up with inflation. Leith Harmon is a financial planner in New York City. She says it's almost impossible for Americans to live off a fixed income account.
Savvy retirees are going to be in a position to recognize that they're going to need to seek other vehicles to increase or maintain the true value of their nest egg.
You might call John Becker a savvy retiree. After serving in Vietnam, he got an MBA, then he had a long career in the metals industry. And now Becker's retired, living in Zebulon, North Carolina, where he keeps a close eye on his 401k.
I watch it like an eagle in case I get to a point where I decide I want to sell or I'm happy enough where it is. I know what debts I have. I know what I need to do.
But many investors who are retired or saving for retirement aren't like Becker. They're not as aggressive. John Graham is a finance professor at Duke University. He says amidst all this economic uncertainty with interest rates so low, savers may feel desperate.
It's really hard for someone who's seeking a reliable 3, 4, 5% return to know where to put their money these days.
And Graham says if they don't know what they're doing, they may take riskier bets on corporate bonds that could default or stocks that could tank. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace Money.
So here's a phrase you probably heard this week, double dip. We're not talking ice cream cones, of course. I wish we were. What it refers to is the idea that instead of coming out of a recession, we're now heading back into one, a second dip in the economy. But Harvard economics professor Ken Rogoff argues that not only are we not in a double dip, we were never in a recession to begin with. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Tuss, for having me.
Let's talk about the difference between a recession and a contraction, because this is what your article was about, and I think a lot of folks would think they're the same thing.
Well, a contraction is a much, much more severe version of a recession that's accompanied by a financial crash. If you have a recession, they last a year, at most 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then once the recovery starts, 6 months later, you're back to where you started. 12 months later, you're perhaps back even at trend. You've made up for lost ground.
And we certainly are not at that point here.
No, we don't have to tell anyone we're not. Yeah. But after a deep financial crisis, this doesn't happen. It takes years. In fact, post-World War II, it takes 4.5 years on average just to get back to where you started with per capita income. And unemployment can drag out for even longer than that.
So what is it that makes this a contraction? You write that it's really all about debt, deleveraging on a global scale, a national scale, and on an individual scale, right?
Well, the defining characteristic of a great contraction is the huge overhang of debt. And frankly, one of the things which has wrong-footed forecasters again and again is that they think it's an ordinary recession, just a bad one, the way maybe you have, instead of a flu, a bad flu. This is like a pneumonia. And not only is it more severe, but the medicine isn't the same. The traditional medicine for recessions doesn't work in quite the same way.
Well, let's talk then about what the appropriate medicine is, because, you know, if you take a look at, for example, the housing situation, what we've had from the government was, you know, the first-time homebuyer credit for a couple of years. You have had a few programs that have tried to address the foreclosure problem. What will work? And beyond housing, what else needs to happen?
Well, I think housing is front and center. That's really the big buildup in consumer debt's been on housing. We had this incredible ebullience, this huge buildup in credit that led to this panic. So I think one of the big question marks that nobody knows the answer to is how far will Americans go? How far will consumers go in building up their balance sheets? And it partly depends on when consumers start to calm down and feel like they can afford to be a little more extended.
One of the questions that we've gotten over the last couple of years from folks who do want to deleverage themselves, a lot of people paying off credit card debt, trying to pay down mortgages. But then at the same time, they're being told that if they don't spend money, it's going to hurt the economy. How do they reconcile that?
Well, I think that we need to have people get their finances in order. And that view that we've got to spend money to help out, that was the first policy approach. We just have to give it a shot in the arm. It's going to get running again. That was a wrong diagnosis. This isn't a typical recession. It's a great contraction, something that has a much longer time frame, slower recovery, and you can't just wish it away.
Kenneth Rogoff is a professor of economics at Harvard. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. We are devoting the rest of the program to your questions about what is going on with the markets and this economy. Last Wednesday, we conducted a live call-in to address your specific worries about your retirement plans, your jobs, your bank accounts. We assembled a roundtable of experts to help us out. Chris Thornburg is an economist and the founder of Beacon Economics, and he joined me at the studios of Station KPCC in Pasadena. Ron Lieber writes the Your Money column for the New York Times and joined us from our bureau in New York. And Carl Richards is a certified financial planner and founder of Prasada Capital Management. He joined us from Station KPCW in Park City, Utah. I started by asking Ron to address this week's big buzzword, volatility. I wondered whether this week was somehow different from every other roller coaster we've been on.
Well, it's always a little bit different than it was last time. But if you're going to play around in the stock market, you have to expect stuff like this to happen sometimes. Either you have faith that over time it's going to deliver the returns that you need, you know, above and beyond what a bond would or what cash would, as it has historically, or you don't. And in the meantime, you've got to live with the volatility.
All right. Carl, what are you telling your clients these days?
You know, I think the time to make decisions about how to act during periods of extreme volatility was before we had it. You don't learn how to use a parachute after you've jumped out of the plane. So hopefully you had a plan going into it. And if that's the case, then stick with your plan.
Well, I'm sure we're going to get some calls asking that direct question. If you haven't planned, what do you do? But before we get to that, Chris, as our token economist on the panel, I do want to ask you, there are a lot of comparisons being made right now to what happened 3 years ago in the fall of 2008. People predicting that we're going into a double dip recession or saying that we actually never came out of one. I know you don't have a crystal ball, but Is this deja vu?
Not really. It is easy to look at these numbers and assume it means we're going to have another recession. But as our other panelists have already alluded to, this sort of market volatility is not unknown. And in fact, sort of one of the long-running jokes in economics is that the stock market has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. My feeling is that this is one of those 4. That is to say that the fundamentals of the economy are not good, but they're not bad either. For an economy to go into a recession where it's actually contracting, there has to be some sort of shock. There has to be some sort of external driver. And boy, I've looked across all the numbers I looked at, and I don't see where it is.
And the debt ceiling wasn't it.
The debt ceiling was absolutely not it.
All right. Well, we will talk some more about this as we go along, but now let's go to the phones. And Nehal is with us from Flushing, New York. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. How are you doing these days?
I'm okay.
Yeah? So what kind of question can we answer for you?
Sure. I was just wondering if this volatility, is it going to stick around or is it eventually just going to fizzle out?
I'll direct that one back to you, Chris. I know we've already established that you don't have a crystal ball. We have no idea what's going to happen in the future. But it does seem like this is an era of volatility, period.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to be a little cautious about that. I mean, as noted, there's been lots of up and down in the markets over the years. However, I would say, even over the last year and a half, you've seen a U.S. economy that's been sort of dawdling along, been in a very slow recovery. And yet, despite that, the financial markets had been booming along. So in a very real sense, it seems to me that this is almost more of a correction.
Hmm.
And the volatility is wrapped around the correction rather than something new and fundamental to the market.
So we're all getting really way overexcited. And at some point, that just has to pull back.
Exactly. Again, the market was way ahead of the curve.
Then, Carl, let me ask you, as a financial advisor, how do you counsel your clients on how to deal with this kind of volatility, if it is the norm?
Well, I think it goes back to making plans long before these experiences happen. So one of the big problems with volatility is it's volatile, right? We don't know when it's coming. And often we have these periods of extreme volatility after periods of relatively benign market behavior. And so it seems like such a shock. So in terms of advice that we give, our advice doesn't really change that much. I mean, when we sit down to build a long-term financial plan, you should incorporate these types of market events because they're embedded in the data you're using for the plan. So therefore, when they come up, they shouldn't necessarily be a surprise. So in reality, what's happening, like, it's not like clients aren't nervous. You get a phone call. It's almost more reminding people that we've already had this discussion. Why don't you come in? Let's review some of the sort of facts and assumptions that we made. Make sure we still feel comfortable with them. Maybe we need to make some changes. But for the most part, let's just stick with the plan.
All right. Let's go to our next caller. And Juan is with us from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Juan.
Good afternoon, everybody.
What's your question for us today?
My question is, with this sudden drop in the Dow, is it foolhardy to jump into the stock market now that prices have depressed somewhat from the values that we saw last week?
All right. Ron, I'm going to direct this to you because I think this is going to be a pattern that we see from a lot of people, which is that they want to make market moves based on what they're seeing from day to day. Give us your spiel on that.
Sure. Well, let's start by saying there's a lot we don't know. We don't know, what he's going to be using this money for, how long he needs to hang on to the money, whether he needs the money soon. All of this stuff is important. But let's assume for a minute that it's retirement money and, you know, he's in his 20s or 30s. He's got a long time horizon. You know, the problem with trying to go all in at any one particular moment is that, you just don't know what's going to happen in the next 7 days, let alone the next 70 days. I mean, I'm not sure anyone could have predicted the volatility of the last week, for instance, and the instances that may or may not have caused it. You know, for somebody who has a long time horizon and has money sitting on the sidelines, sure. I mean, stocks are whatever they are, 15 or 20% less than they were a couple of weeks ago. This is a perfectly good time to start. But I don't know if I would make big bets all of a sudden one way or the other. You know, I might start with 20% of my money or a quarter of my money and then parcel it in over the course of, many months or a couple of years, depending on how long you intend to save it for.
And Carl, that's something that, we really encourage people to do is not to make big, massive moves while the market is doing the same thing.
Yeah, no, I don't. I mean, again, I hate to sound like a broken record all the time, but I think it's always important, right, to look back and say, look, what are my goals? What am I trying to accomplish? If this money, like Ron mentioned, is supposed to be invested for the long term, sure, buying today feels better than buying 2 weeks ago. But we don't know what it's going to feel like a week from now. And so to me, I still love, you know, Warren Buffett's got a lot of great quotes, but still love the quote when he said, the best time to buy is whenever you have money, and the best time to sell is never.
All right, let's go to our next caller, and Dave is with us from Salt Lake City. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
Very well. How are you feeling these days?
You know, I felt better,
yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah, probably all of us have. So how can we help you out today? What's your question?
You know, I'm a pretty typical 401k investor, and, you know, you prepare for the downs with the ups, but when the downs come, it kind of takes the wind out of your sail. And
yep.
I read something the other day. It was actually in Carl's blog, and he said that the planning process must include a discussion about risk and even include lifeboat drills to see how you react before you hit the water, which I thought was a pretty great analogy. The only thing is I don't exactly know what those drills should be. I was to prepare myself for it.
All right, Carl, if you are up any sort of creek without a paddle?
Well, yeah, the lifeboat drill. Luckily for all of us, if we've been investing the last 3 to 5 years, we've already had an experience we can look back on. If you had money invested in 2008, you know what it feels like to live through an event in the marketplace. That's why I get sort of fired up about the idea that this is a surprise. And we just went through one of these periods. So we can look back at those and say, look, how did I react then? And I suggest making these changes, like you alluded to, Tess, let's make these changes when we're back on the cruise ship, if you will, not while we're in the lifeboat. But once we get back on the ship, we should take note how we're feeling. I mean, if you sold in 2008 and you sold now, it's time to make a different plan.
Well, and in fact, you know, in the New York Times this week, in your blog post, you suggested that people take a video of themselves, talk to themselves right now, and use that next time we have some sort of market volatility again.
Well, we did that in 2008.
Yeah.
We had people come in that absolutely wanted to pull the plug. We encourage them, hey, why don't we wait just a little while till we're back on the boat? But will you do me a favor? Write yourself a little letter, label it, you know, when the Dow's back at 13,000, please open. and I think the video is even a better idea. Like, record a little video of yourself. Give it to your spouse. Give it to your friend. Give it to your parent. And say, look, when the market's all recovered, please make me watch this.
Let's go next to Melissa in Atlanta. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. What's your question for us today?
Well, if I were thinking of refinancing my home, would now be a good time? Just trying to get my ducks in a row, and I really have no idea where to go.
All right. Good question. I'm going to direct this to you, Chris, because you've done a lot in the area of the economics of housing. And, you know, we have seen people write in this week asking not only about refinancing, but about whether, you know, they're in the process of even buying a house. Perhaps they're even in escrow and they're wondering, maybe I just need to drop this at this point. People who are looking at these interest rates, what should
right.
they be looking at?
And let me start. So, 6 months ago, I made a comment to some of my folks and I said, look, if you're going to refinance your house, do it now because it's highly unlikely you'll see interest rates this low again, ever again, or even lower. No, there was an asterisk on the back of that. And the asterisk said, unless there was an unnecessary market panic, which drives everybody into bonds. So you didn't see the asterisk. And that's the key here. Yes, this is a great time to go out and refinance. And by the way, you're not the only person doing it. Over the course of the last week, there's been a huge spike in mortgage applications. Everybody's rushing out there. This could be a nice opportunity for you. Get out there and do it for sure.
What about the folks who are who basically decided that things were good enough that they were going to go ahead and look at buying a house at this point? I mean, I've talked to people this week who were at that point. Now they look at just how crazy things have gotten, and they're like, well, maybe I need to wait again.
Yeah. So I have my own metaphor. The stock market is a 13-year-old daughter of the world economy. It's the ultimate drama queen.
And you don't want anyone to date her?
Well, maybe that too. But again, whatever news comes out, it overreacts on the up and on the down. And that's what we're going through right now.
All right.
Tess, can I add something to that one?
Ron?
So just one more thing to add there. You may be scared, but think about how scared the seller is that you're going to walk away. You have an opportunity right now to use what's going on in the background as a battering ram in negotiations.
Nice.
Except for now you gave it away.
All right, let's go next to Doug in Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well. How are things there in Omaha?
Good, good. I should qualify that.
Okay. How are you going to qualify it?
Well, I'm in a commission-based sales job, very much related to the home building industry.
Uh-oh.
And well, my big picture question is, I hear in the radio, TV news about government intervention. Should the government stimulate the economy? What is the truth?
Oh, who do we believe? All right. Political question, not something we deal with a whole lot on this program, but I suppose I'm going to toss it over to our economist. What's your take on intervention versus not intervention?
I think intervention can be a positive thing when it's channeled correctly. For example, much of the focus over the last couple of years in trying to stimulate the economy has been wrapped around consumer spending, trying to boost consumer spending. The problem with that is that when this recession began, people were spending way too much. We had this false sense of wealth wrapped around the financial markets, wrapped around our home values.
Wrapped around credit.
Exactly, wrapped around credit. And as a result, that people were vastly overspending. And it's almost as if the government has been trying to maintain the excessive level of spending. That will not ultimately help the economy because eventually the stimulus goes away and consumer spending is going to have to fall back down to a natural level. My feeling has always been if they were going to do stimulus, they should have focused a lot more on things that are going to have more domestic impact. For example, there was big talk about a big infrastructure investment in the U.S. economy. But all said and done, we haven't seen those numbers. I think we do need some degree of stimulus, but I also think that the criticisms about how the stimulus has worked so far are also quite valid. I didn't answer your question directly, but as an economist, I'm required to do that.
What do you think, Doug? Does that do it for you?
I somewhat understand what he's saying, but I guess my question stems from what drives me batty is when I hear things like this, there's the political answer and the economic answer.
I think it drives you batty. I'm an economist. It makes me nuts.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Okay.
Good question.
Thank you.
Let's go next to Deborah in Elk City. Hi, Deborah.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Just fine, thank you.
All right, how can we help you out?
My husband and I have been in the process of negotiating to buy a second small business. And so whenever the U.S. credit rating was downgraded last week, we kind of, you know, took a big gulp because here we are talking to the bank and we're wondering, oh my goodness, now what is the interest rate going to be for us? And then the Fed says, no, we're not going to raise interest rates. And so we're kind of confused. Should we look at it kind of like buying a house? Well, if interest rates are high, go ahead and buy the house. And then in a couple of years, if interest rates go down, you can refinance it. You know, we feel like we're in limbo.
Can I ask what kind of business this is?
Well, it's a liquor store.
Oh, you'll be in business forever. You will never run out of customers.
Pray for market volatility.
Well, bearing in mind that, you know, we can't give you a whole lot of advice because we haven't seen a business plan. We don't know all the details. But I will tell you that Chris was rolling his eyes while you were talking.
Yeah.
Tell us why.
Yeah. And your question was really about interest rates. And so let's focus on that. First of all, the Fed doesn't set long-term interest rates. The bond market does. And similarly, when S&P talks about upgrading or downgrading certain types of debt, that's a recommendation. It doesn't actually drive anything. So what you should be looking at are the actual numbers. And here are the actual numbers. Interest rates are going down. So the bond market apparently doesn't think whatever S&P says is realistic. And I tend to agree with the bond market. I think it's a bunch of silliness.
Everybody went out and bought bonds
exactly.
on Monday morning.
Exactly. Because obviously stock market volatility pushed people in that particular direction. So from that basis, this is a very good time to go out and borrow to buy some sort of business. By the way, let me throw this out there as well. You should consider small business loans. The SBA has a bunch of very good products for people trying to buy or start small businesses. Make sure you talk to your banker about those products as well.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. I'm going to go to the Twitter feed now, and Musa tweeted me from New York. He says, I'm losing 20 to 40% of my portfolio. I'd like to know what he's in at that point, because the market has not gone that far down. But his real question he's asking is, gold safe? Is gold not a big, big bubble? Ron, I know you have written about gold, and nothing wrong with having it in your portfolio, but there are a lot of gold bugs out there, right?
Exactly. Look, we don't know what he has in mind, right? But if he's thinking about selling everything he has and investing in anything, you know, 100%, whether it's gold or oil futures, it's never a good idea to go all in on any investment, particularly one that's had an incredible run-up like gold. Look, I have no idea what gold is going to do over the next 3 to 5 years.
If you did, you'd be on your private yacht in the Caribbean.
And it would have gold faucets, yes. But it's almost never a good idea to have too much of your net worth tied up in a single investment, particularly one that's had such a great run. There's just, you know, that you're basically doubling your risk there.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Now back to our call-in, recorded on Wednesday. Our guests were economist Chris Thornburg, New York Times columnist Ron Lieber, and financial advisor Carl Richards. Our next call came from Stuart in Wisconsin.
Hello, how are you?
Very well. How are you doing today?
Very, very good.
Yeah, well, I'd like to hear that.
Yes.
But you have a question for us.
Yes, I do. Similar to the caller before who was talking about whether or not she should go in and buy this small business, and this kind of goes more to the economist, how many people like her does he think, you know, are out there and are affected by the volatility in the markets, which may be kind of hindering them from going out and making those investments?
Oh, that's a good question. I think if I may boil your question down, what you're asking me is, how important a role does psychology play in our economy?
100%?
Not as much as you might think.
No.
You know, our best measures of confidence, say the Consumer Confidence Index, are actually not terribly good indicators.
Don't they survey like 200 people or something out of the University of Michigan?
And 20 years ago was a decent indicator, because 20 years ago when they asked you that question, you really just thought about your job, your company, your life.
Was that pre-CNBC?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because what you get now is just a feedback effect. Whatever is being screamed on the news network that morning gets fed back through those surveys. So it's hard to see. I mean, clearly psychology does play a role out there, but measuring it is difficult. And there's something else to keep in mind. Right now, everybody's freaking out. But these periods tend to drift away reasonably quickly from a business perspective. In a couple of weeks, this is going to be history. Obviously, that wasn't the case in 2008. But in 2008, there were much more profound things going on in the U.S. economy. We had the unwinding of the real estate bubble. We had the collapse of Lehman. We had a massive recession that was just kicking into gear. This time around, there really are no profound problems with the U.S. economy. And with that in mind—
Well, but what about jobs, the housing market?
Well, again—
Those are awfully profound.
No, but they're improving slowly.
Very slowly.
But they're improving.
Yeah.
So everything says we are in the midst of a continued slow recovery. And that means once this correction's behind us, things will start to smooth out. My guess is, and as always, a forecaster, I got my snake bones and my dust I'm throwing in the air over here. 3 or 4 weeks, this is going to be behind us, and whatever psychology was there will be removed, and the screaming heads on 24-hour news are going to have to go out and find something else to scream about.
All right, you heard it here first. Mark is with us next in Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Mark.
Hello, hi.
Hi there. What's your question for us today?
So I was considering buying a house until Thursday, and now I'm wondering if I should take the money I've saved and put it into the stock market to save for retirement, since I haven't done that yet.
Okay. Earlier, we were talking about how this is not the time to make really rash decisions like that with your money. And Ron, really, again, the lesson here that we keep saying over and over and over again is that it's not the time to make massive moves and big decisions. You know, you got to take it slow no matter what's happening on a day-to-day basis.
Right. But the thing about the situation that the caller is in, I mean, the first thing I'd ask, you know, if he hasn't saved for retirement yet and he's relatively young, you know, I'd want to know if his employer is matching the contributions, because if so, he needs to be saving for retirement and getting that match and buying a home if it's really important to him. But, you know, the thing to remember right now is that, you know, it looks like interest rates, mortgage interest rates are going to be pretty low for a little while longer. And it looks like, we can't be sure, that housing prices are probably going to not rise too quickly, if they rise at all, anytime soon. So unless this is an A-plus opportunity in the very best school district or whatever your parameters are, you can probably wait another couple of months. And it's probably a good idea to start saving for retirement now when compound interest can work for you that much more quickly. But, you know, it may not be an either or.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mark. And let's go next to Michael in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well. How are you doing today?
Good, good. I wanted to know, how will the change in the debt rating affect the typical investor in the U.S.?
You mean investors in bonds?
Investors in bonds, yes.
Chris, you want to take a stab at that one? Is that going to make any difference?
Well, again, look at the numbers.
Yeah. Everybody
interest rates are down.
Went into bonds.
Everyone into bonds. If you take a step back, keep something in mind. The decline in the rating was AAA to AA+. If you actually sat down and sort of looked at AAA versus AA+ bonds, the difference in interest rates is very small. It really doesn't make all that big of a difference from an interest rate perspective.
Let me ask you then, when we're talking about the downgrade, so many people feel like that was the cause of what has happened with the stock markets this week. Would you say it was more of a catalyst that this correction, which is what you're calling it, would have happened anyway? Something else would have triggered it?
Yeah. When you have this much dry tinder on the ground, it takes any spark to set it off. And in the case of the stock market, that spark could be completely imaginary.
Well, and Tess, one thought that I think sometimes gets missed in this whole, you know, sort of Fed policy of keeping short rates really low, at least. The flip side of being excited about low interest rates for your house, you know, maybe your grandmother is living on a quarter of what she was 5 years ago.
Hmm. Well, you know, this is actually a question that's come into our inbox several times this week, which is particularly since the Fed announcement on Tuesday. What are people supposed to do to get some sort of bang for their buck at this point? The stock market was the answer, you know, over the last couple of years, and now nobody wants to go there. You know, is there any safe place where you can get something more than a quarter percentage point?
Well, I think the safest thing to do is to earn more. I mean, we forget that sometimes, right? You know, we're trying to eke out yield where we can. But Ramit Sethi at IWillTeachYouToBeRich.com has harped on this theme again. He's written about it. And, you know, if there's some way that you can figure out to earn an extra couple hundred dollars a month by doing some work on the side, that can actually make an appreciable difference. And, you know, it isn't the easiest thing for a 77-year-old to do. It isn't the easiest thing for a 37-year-old to do. But that may be the best shot you have if you're not willing to take on additional risk.
Well, and Tess, to your direct question too, I think people need to be really, really careful when you're trying to, we refer to it as stretch for yield, right? When you're looking for that, oh my gosh, my CD is only getting 1.5%. I need something more. Oh, look, here is a product somebody's trying to sell me that yields 5.5%, and they said it's just like a CD. You know, if it yields 5.5%, it's not just like a CD.
As always, if it looks too good to be true, it is. All right, let's go next to Juana in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hi, Juana.
Hi.
How are you doing today?
Not too bad. And I just have a very kind of general question.
Okay.
Okay, I have a 401k, and usually they have those little pie charts to show you what your asset mix should be. And, you know, since the whole economy has done a backflip, I was wondering if those kind of little tables and things are going to change. Or is it still conventional wisdom? You know, it's the same kind of belief, you know. I'm just curious because I keep waiting for some big news to come through, like, oh, everybody's philosophy has changed because, you know, the world has changed.
Right. Ron, let me throw that to you because I think there have been a lot of questions about kind of conventional wisdom. People have asked those questions over the last 3 years. You know, does buy and hold no longer apply? Is asset allocation somehow different now than it was even 5 years ago? What's your answer to that?
I'm not sure it's going to change a lot anytime soon. I mean, you know, you have people who are outliers who are saying, you know, you need to be majority in commodities or you need to be 100% in bonds because that would have worked if you had divided it this way or that over the last 20 or 30 years. But the past doesn't predict the future. And the only thing we know with reasonable certainty is that stocks do return more than bonds and bonds do return more than cash. And the reason why they do is because they're riskier. Now, that's not to say that it's the right answer for you, because if you don't like the risk, then you should do something that's less risky. You know, the only problem with that is it means you're going to need to work longer or you're going to need to save more. But that may be the right answer for you.
Tess, can I just can't help myself from jumping in on that one question, because
I
think the question, right, the caller, Ron, hit it on the head, is that those charts are sort of a shortcut. This idea of risk tolerance, to me, I think is one of the silliest ideas that was ever created by the financial services industry. And that's saying a lot, right? I think the idea that we should make decisions based off of some 10-point questionnaire about risk tolerance makes a bunch of assumptions. Number one, that risk tolerance even exists. Number two, that it doesn't change. My point is, focusing just on risk tolerance, I think, is a recipe for disaster. I think the better way to approach that asset allocation decision is based on a plan where you determine how much return do you need to make these goals work. After you've determined that, you say, okay, that means I'd have to have this much in equities. Then you go say, okay, time for lifeboat drill. If I had that much in equities, I would have felt this way in 08. Ooh, I don't like that. Well, then you go to what Ron said. Work a little bit longer, save a little bit more. We've led people down this risk tolerance questionnaire path far too long. It's better to make that decision based off how much you need to make your plan work.
And finally, we have Greg from Troy, Maine. Hi, Greg.
How you doing there?
We're doing great. How are you doing?
Good, good. Well, my question is sort of a little bit more nuts and boltsy, and that is, who exactly is doing all this massive selling of securities? You know, I don't know anyone who woke up the other day and said, oh, my goodness, the United States has a double A rating, and I'm going to have to fire sale out my IRA. You know, it worked pretty hard for my money, and it really is disappointing to see it go into the dumpster every time someone feels the sky is falling.
Good question. I'm going to direct this to you, Chris, because I think it brings us right around to the very beginning of the conversation that we had here, which is about volatility. And the fact that people feel like there's such a lack of control that even if they're doing everything right, they're subjected to, you know, these huge traders who move in and out of the market without a thought to all the individuals that they're affecting.
But that's why you get paid for it.
And
with that in mind, you always got to keep something in mind, is that we always talk about the market as if it's some sort of
blob,
abstract, you know, numbers that pour down from the heavens. And
right.
It's not. It's made up of a bunch of guys.
And they are mostly guys, I'll point out.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of electronics trading programs now. A lot of it is even guys. It's just algorithms written
right
by some Russian scientist. And as such, I actually think that the market has gotten perhaps a little too disconnected. Again, we've seen these big run-ups and downturns over the past bunch of years. 6-7 months ago, we had the big flash crash. And it all goes back to this idea that volatility is based on human decision-making.
Yeah.
And you just got to, that when you invest in the stock market, that's what you're taking on, and you have to keep that in mind.
Ron?
Right. And something else I would add is the fact that, you know, when you're in the middle of a volatile moment, it sort of feels like it's going to last forever. I've been back and forth with the folks at Vanguard about this week, and, you know, we've looked at the volatility numbers going back to the mid-90s, and on average, it actually hasn't increased so much, you know, which is difficult to believe. And I didn't believe it at first, you know, when you've been kicked in the face in 2008 and you feel like you're being kicked in the face now. But we actually had a very calm period from, you know, 2002 to 2007. And it may continue. Look, we don't know what's going to happen. But just because what's happening now feels like an out-of-the-ordinary event doesn't mean that that's the new normal and that the game is somehow rigged.
Well, then, Carl, let me end with you and maybe talk us through, because I know you've done many, many napkin sketches to this effect. Talk us through how we absorb that rationally. I mean, maybe our brains know that we're not supposed to be freaking out at this point, but our emotions aren't there. How do we talk ourselves down from the ledge?
The problem may be that our brains do think we're supposed to be freaking out, right? Mm. Like, we're trained to get away from things that are causing us pain. You know, if it weren't so, we would have been eaten by saber-tooths a long time ago. We need to recognize that it's okay to feel that way. Unless you wake up in the morning and see Warren Buffett in the mirror, you're most likely genetically wired to be incredibly nervous when everybody around you is incredibly nervous. Mm-hmm. And so give yourself permission to feel that way, but recognize that you shouldn't make decisions when you're feeling that way. Take your time, think about these things carefully, then make a decision.
All right. And Chris is here in the studio with me, wants to...
Last thing to keep in mind, that asset prices should be based on fundamentals. We forget about that quite a bit. I mean, I was living here in California when home prices were rising by 20% per year, and a lot of Californians are running around thinking that they were home rich. They mm-hmm. counted their wealth in millions because of all the housing equity they had. And then prices crashed down, and they felt terrible because they lost all that money.
They didn't have that money.
That money didn't exist. It was a figment of the market's imagination because housing was never worth that much in California. It was driven up by a bubble.
Your asset is only worth what's in the bank.
It's exactly. As an economist, I will also say this. You know, they say economists watch the market. I look at my 401k once a year.
Really?
There's no point. There's all sorts of studies out there that say people who trade actively underperform the market. So when they send me my statement, great. Otherwise, I completely ignore it.
Ron, how often do you look at yours?
I can't remember the last time I looked at it. I actually made some adjustments to the funds, and I took a close look at it a couple of months ago when I was writing about how bad the fund choices usually are in 401k plans.
Yeah.
So I wanted to review what we have, but I'm basically with Chris. I mean, I don't look at my investments that often. You know, the only thing I'm looking at them right now for is to think about, you know, whether it's time to rebalance, to, you know, buy some more stocks after having sold some bonds and looking at potentially putting some spare cash to work.
Carl, how often do you look? Well, you're a financial advisor. You must look a little more often than the rest of us. Well,
yeah, it's a bit problematic simply because my money's invested the way my client's money is. So if I'm looking right. for a client, I automatically know what's going on with mine. But we certainly don't make any changes unless something changes in my life. Not based on what changes in the market.
Ron Lieber is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Thank you so much for helping us out today.
Good to be here.
And Carl Richards is a financial advisor with the Prasada Capital Management in Utah. He's also the napkin Sharpie sketcher who's been on the show several times before. You can also find him on the Bucks blog in the New York Times. Thank you.
Thank you, Tess. It was a pleasure.
And Chris Thornburg is an economist and the founder of Beacon Economics here in Los Angeles. Thanks for coming in.
Always fun.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, sayonara, folks. I'm on vacation, head planted firmly in the sand. The inimitable David Brancaccio, the man, the myth, the legend, will be sitting in this chair. And tell you what, while I'm gone, why don't you make one of those videos Carl Richards was talking about and send it to us. We'll put it up on our website. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Avishai Artsy. Special thanks this week to Patty Hirsch and the staff at KPCC in Pasadena for letting us borrow their Collins studios. Interest-free. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. Someone else. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.